Good morning. Bonjour. My name is George Fechnik. I'm one of the co-founders at the Microsoft Pioneer Studios. And it's actually a true pleasure to be back in Belgium. My family moved here over 30 years ago, but I left when I was 8, but spent some time being educated in Belgium, went to the École Européenne de Nuclé, and from a very early age on was, I think, heavily influenced by the European mindset of bringing cultures, different countries together. And it's been something that has stuck with me. I think I was paying with euros before the euro existed. Trucks were crossing boundaries before the Shangela Upcoming existed. So crossing boundaries and bringing different teams together has been something that has been at the core of what I do and believe in. Talk today is going to be about design venture. And design venture is about putting together design and business and really looking at those two separate disciplines, bring them together to explore new opportunities. In a broader way, you can think of it as design thinking, sort of the tool set of sketching, of doing user research, of looking into envisioning of opportunities, kind of the right brain, right mode of thinking, and putting that together with entrepreneurship, with some of the business opportunities, and using then design to evaluate, assess, and then develop new business opportunities. This actually has its origin when you go back in time. This gentleman, I don't know if you know him, but this is Peter Drucker. Are there any MBAs in the audience? Anyone with an MBA, business degree? No. Okay, well, if you want a little bit of an MBA, read some of Peter Drucker's work. Peter Drucker is one of prominent figures in management, but he also wrote several books on innovation and entrepreneurship. And in one of his seminal works in 1985, he wrote a book on entrepreneurship and innovation. And he says that, quote, like the second imperative of innovation is therefore to go out, look, to ask, to listen. Successful innovators use both the right and the left side of their brains. They look at figures, they look at people. So what he says is if you want to go out and create a new idea, create a new business, it really starts by observing the world around you, people, understanding cultural trends, understanding forms. And and then at the same time, you need to study the facts, the technology, the numbers, and then make links between them. So it's not that you just have to look at people or just have to look at technology or facts and figures. You have to make the crossover. And it turns out that design is a very good way to facilitate that crossover. Coincidentally, over the last 5 to 10 years, or probably the last five years, there have been a number of design ventures and teams that have taken this on as a focus. In the mergers and acquisition space, there have been several acquisitions. Austin Ventures acquired Exopolis, a digital agency, last year. HTC acquired One & Co, industrial design shop in San Francisco. Cisco acquired Modo. This is not Motorola, but Modo, the product design shop in San Francisco. Flextronic acquired Frog. And then there are several design firms and design agencies have actually shifted their business model to start designing for equity rather than for a fee. Very notable example here is EaseVR with Fuse Project and his Jawbone device. IDEO recently launched Shopwell, which is a shopping network. So that was funded with $4 million. And then even advertising agencies, someone like An Anomaly, is starting to launch, rather than just creating ads, they're actually creating brands and products with people. A really good example here is by Lauren Luke. This is where they took a makeup artist on YouTube, found a makeup artist who had hundreds of millions of views, and started developing a brand and a makeup line for that person, and launched that then with a makeup company. So it's really interesting seeing a lot of design agencies doing design work in exchange for equity. And most recently, there are several companies that have been founded around that principle with that as a core focus. The Co-Collectives, Ty Montague's work came out of J. Walter Thompson, and they're predominantly focused on co-creation. Jackson Fish is a design studio in Seattle that doesn't just offer design service, but also ships their own products. And it's a very, very exciting time. A lot of this, of course, for interactive shops is fueled by apps and the marketplace that was created around apps. But fundamentally, what we're seeing is a larger shift where design is playing a much bigger role in the shaping and the creation of businesses. So at Microsoft 3 years ago, Ray Riley, Paula Mulabuyo, Albert Chum, myself, and a few others co-founded the Pioneer Studios. This is a photo of our studio space. It's our objective is to develop and create new consumer products and consumer services for Microsoft. And we do this with a very strong brand and design point of view. We're located in downtown Seattle. We've got a small offshoot in New York as well. We like our coffee. It's good. The sun does shine in Seattle, and it's a very, very inspirational place to be. Over the years, we've started designing from everything from really small form factor, ultra mobile media experiences with services parts behind it, to exploring a lot of new mobile phone concepts, initial planning work and user insight work that went into informing Windows Phone 7. We worked on alternate form factors, emerging form factors, two-screen devices with pen and touch, and all the way up to large screen size experiences. So here were transmedia experiences where videos will work with laptops, TVs, and bring that all together. And this work you'll actually start seeing launch later this year with the refresh of Xbox 360 and Kinect. So a lot of the media experiences that they'll be launching, we helped shape. So what's unique about the Pioneer Studios is first that we're internal to Microsoft. We only work for Microsoft. And a lot of the designs that we do are fairly large scale. Being at Microsoft, the business opportunities have to be a certain size. So we're looking at 100 million and above type of markets. It introduces a certain level of complexity. Usually the design works require hardware, software, and services. Managing a consistent experience across those three axes is fairly challenging. And we're complete, meaning that we start all the way from concept, early user research work, all the way to go-to-market strategy, what it would take to bring a product into market. So some of the things that isn't unique about us is that, as many venture teams, our projects fail. So we have about a 20% success rate in our projects. That's kind of the industry average here. So, but oftentimes our work just doesn't go anywhere. That's one of the perils of being an entrepreneur. But when things do go well, that's always exciting to see. And the other part is that this entire field of design venturing and using design to really create new business is fairly nascent. It's young. We don't have everything figured out. And we're still actively learning. So at the risk of oversharing and starting to say something, we're going to be somewhat courageous. And what I'm going to do in this talk today is actually share some of the things that we learned. This can just be as good as what I've learned and what I've learned over the last 3 years, but I'll make sure that this is entertaining for you, and I'll share some of the stories and diagrams and case studies. So the first is when you look at an innovation process, there are many, many different innovation processes, but roughly they'll look like this. You take some insights from a marketplace, you develop a core idea. Here, the core idea is an expression of what that opportunity is. It could be the brand, it could be a specific idea. You develop into a product and eventually bring it to market, and then that cycle repeats. So going from insight to product to market, and eventually with more established products, you can rely on the market that you've built to draw insights and build your product. So the first step really is finding the right insights and then articulating those as a core idea. And what is challenging about this is that means you have to go out and study people, and people are complicated, right? They do strange things. There's usually a lot of information out there, and working with a very murky world that is always around us, and distilling that down to an opportunity is actually it's fairly hard work. It's a very, very hazy field. So a framework that we took quite directly from Wolf Olin's, because it works really well, is the idea of a core idea. And the way how you get to a core idea is by asking two questions. The first is, what's unique about you? So in this case, what's unique about Microsoft, or what's unique about your business? And looking at some of the functional advantages and some of the functional capabilities, core competencies you have, but also some of the emotional, the tonal sides of it. At the same time, you need to ask, well, what does the world need right now? So the world being the market that you're addressing, the customer base that you'd like to have, and trying to understand what their functional needs are, but also their emotional needs. And at the intersection of those, a narrative then emerges that you can pair with a core idea that will guide you then through your development, may that be hardware, software, or services. So it's really bringing together those two insights from, you know, what's unique about you, what does the world right now need, and finding the intersection of those two. So this seems a little bit abstract, and it is a little abstract, so let's make it more concrete. This is going to be my first case story about some design work we did in India a couple of years ago, looking into television or TV services and where they're headed. And you know, I'd love to recreate the excitement of being in India and the noise and the scents and the food and all of this, but since we can't go there, I decided to bring a video. So are you ready to go to India? Yeah? You ready? Okay, let's go.
మొబైల్ ఫోన్ రెండు యూజ్ అవుతాయండి, ఒకటి పర్సనల్కి ఒకటి ఆఫీస్ పర్పస్కి.
ఇంటికి డెలివరీ చేస్తాం, ఎక్కడికైనా సరే డెలివరీ చేస్తాం.
Yeah, so a lot of these titles here are, this was a draft video cut, but we ended up filling in some of those titles. But one of the things you start seeing that print readership is on the rise in India, but it turns out there's another thing that's on the rise, which is radio. So FM radio, there are more FM radio stations that are being created in India every day. Does anyone have an idea why that is the case? Why is FM radio on the rise in India? Anyone want to venture a guess? Many different languages, that would be one motivating factor, yeah?
Cheap devices.
Cheap devices. Can you share a little bit more?
Well, India is not a very rich country, so
yeah. Yeah, that's right. So there are now 300 million mobile phones in India alone. Nokia is the largest supplier of mobile phones. There are Nokia, several years ago, made the decision to include a radio in the mobile phones. So as a result, large percentage of the population now has a radio in their pocket for the very first time, and the way to experience. And so there is now an increased demand on listening to radio. But the main thing we were looking at is actually how people are looking at televisions. So we spent time with families and speaking about their television viewing habits, looking at where televisions are located in the home. And one thing that stood out is that a lot of the technology, or a lot even the habitats, are built around shared communal property. So this is actually a fairly typical setup where there is a center temple with five families built around that temple, where the temple is shared amongst those five families. And this also translates into technology use. So when you look at internet sharing, so when you ask people, well, how do you get to the internet? I mean, people will pull out a USB key. And the way this works is that the father hands the son a USB key. The son walks to an internet cafe, downloads MP3s and videos from there, comes back, and then they play internet videos on their DVD player. So it's so sort of the first way of you know, sharing internet content works over USB keys and in a fairly broad way. A more sophisticated way of internet sharing is then broadband modems, and they're still fairly expensive. So even these broadband modems will be bought by multiple families. And the lesson here is that when you design technology or project for products for the Indian market, it's very important to design them for multi-people use. This has economic advantages. Multiple people can go in and now buy something that is usually more expensive. But there are also actually some cultural reasons for why people want to share and their technology. The other thing that was interesting, so this was work we did in 2008 as you know, our banking system was heading into a recession and the entire world seemed to have been going into a financial meltdown. And to my great surprise, I mean, the cranes were still working, the cars were still driving. I mean, everything still just seemed to be chugging just along just fine in India. And it was a really interesting thing where you know, the Europe and the United States were, you know, were about to collapse. India was just building their roads, their streets. And one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the Indian economy and a lot of the savings of India are actually based in gold. A good example for this is this ad. This is an advertisement for a gold savings account telling you, you know, to quit smoking and for 18 rupees a day you can start your own gold savings account. There's actually a beautiful story around this. If you want to borrow $1 in India, you need to have $4 in savings, right? So if you want $1, you got to put $4 into savings. In the United States, if you want to borrow, if you put $1 into savings, you're able to borrow $35. So it's just different perspective on you know, what the savings actually means. But it also has a deeper meaning, like the idea of saving and building up and investing into future generations. Gold plays a very important role in dowries and exchanges, but also in enabling the future for children. And this is some very important, the phase of being a student is a very important role in Hinduism and providing for students and providing for your children's future is just an incredibly important activity. And it's also a communal activity in India. And it's not just fundamentally altruistic. I mean, you have to understand that India is on a tremendous growth path, and it's not uncommon that a son can make 10 to 100 times more than their father in the first 2 years into a job. I mean, think about that. Like, right out of school, 2 years later, you're making 100 times more than your father. Right? That's just incredible. What type of growth opportunities there are. You know, a way to see this is here, when you look at, you know, mom and dad have like, you know, mom doesn't have a cell phone, she'll have like a transistor radio, dad will have an obsolete cell phone, but the first son will have two cell phones, even a state-of-the-art smartphone that would be considered even expensive in the United States or in Europe. So it's the country is on an incredible economic trajectory, and there are and there are tremendous opportunities available to individuals, and there are also great responsibilities that person then bears because the entire family is looking to them to bring on the next generation. So you know that trajectory is steep. It's plentiful. It brings many opportunities, but it also brings a lot of responsibilities and fear and uncertainty about, well, how is the future going to change? How is this going to affect our family? What does it mean if my son or daughter have to move abroad in the pursuit of their own opportunities? So this is the type of user research we're doing in the field. At the same time, we're looking at business information, technology trends, and trying to map all of this together. And here's like a session where we're working with the team in India, mapping out, you know, what are all of those different trends? What are some of the insights that are resonating with everyone? And then, you know, you apply the framework. you know, when you look at, well, what is going on with India right now? So it's a country on tremendous economic growth. There are great opportunities there. Young kids are able to travel and to explore the world and to make substantially more than the generations before them. But at the same time, there are fears, there are worries about, well, how is the family going to stay together? How are you going to stay in touch with your loved ones? Some of the functional requirements, I'm not going to dwell too much on that, but what people articulated is the ability to like to pay bills. It's a fairly pronounced one because bill payment counters only are open for a few hours a week, being able to share photos. So there's some very, you know, fairly straightforward functional requirements that you see emerging as well. Now, when you look at, well, what can Microsoft do, right? So what's unique about Microsoft? When you look more about the tone and the brand, Microsoft is very well perceived in India. Bill Gates is seen as an entrepreneur, something to aspire to. The PC is aligned with education and a lot of the values. It's seen as a way to, it's as a tool that can empower people. And on the technology side and the functional side, Microsoft has a lot to offer as well, from television services to Bing to educational products. So a whole wide range of different things that Microsoft has to offer there. And when you start putting that together, right, and you realize that there are actually many employees also at Microsoft who are feeling that stress, that, you know, they themselves went on their journey and they have families in other places, and in particular many Indians, there's this narrative that emerges, the narrative that everyone is part of a family. And increasingly we're being faced with digital and geographic divides as we pursue our own individual journeys. But how can you bring together the sensation of closeness of family? How can you do that over time? And one of the engineers then came up with the one core idea, single word that expressed that desire of closeness. And it's the word Haveli. Haveli is the idea. It's a temple that resides at the center of multiple families. It's a symbol of affluence. It's an aspirational space. It's a place where people can sit and repose and have conversations. And it's something that grows over time. And so Haveli is a core idea. It is not a product. It is not a brand. But it is a sentiment. It's a spirit that you can start designing for and translating into a product. And the way you can do this is by asking some very practical questions, such as, well, what should we build? You know, what of all the different things that Microsoft has to offer should feel like Haveli and which don't? So here's like an example how you can use like the core idea of Haveli now to focus your execution. So should we include video chat? Yep, that seems like a good thing because families want to see each other and connect. Does the service have to be international? Absolutely. Right, the families are going to grow apart. They're going to move, but you know, if you're able to connect different people and consumers in different markets and bring them back together in a virtual place, that would be a very good thing. Should there be office support? Should there be the ability to write letters, PowerPoint presentations, and spreadsheets? Probably not. It's practical for family use, but it's not really at the core of building that Haveli-like place. Should there be single-player games? No, that just makes no sense to include, right? So here in this case, you then use this core idea to start weeding out and making some very, you know, fairly complex product decisions, and it will guide you throughout the entire phases of all the way to market. This was actually a quick sketch that you know, someone on the team ended up doing. One of the developers we were working with then designed this super, super large television with multiple families coming together, and I really, really enjoyed this image because it captured that spirit of people going on many journeys but still being able to maintain one family. So to summarize, for the core idea, you get it by synthesizing the two questions, asking yourself really critically and holistically, you know, what's unique about you? What is special? You know, who are the people that you work with and the things that you do and who you want to stand for, right? I mean, these are a lot of those questions that you start. And what are the great things you've done in the past that you can rely on? So this is the question of what's unique about you. And then looking at, you know, what does the world around you need? And looking at the intersection of those two and then picking a straightforward path. And it's important to explore both the functional and the emotional dimensions. The functional dimensions are pretty easy to observe usually. Technologies you've mastered, different skills you have. The emotional dimension is actually sometimes harder for people to say because you need to start saying like, well, this is kind of, you're making comments about your lifestyle and you're in comments about who you want to be. But the good thing about having then that core idea is that you can use it to make simplicity. So the next step is, now that you have a core idea, you can start building a product in different areas. And in reality, you're already like taking stabs at creating a product at the same time. But taking now this core idea and translating it into product is the next step in developing the opportunity. And there are many ways to do this. I mean, there are so many ways, and I'm not going to dwell on this. I mean, pretty much Remix is a lot about this, about development tools, everything from wireframing. There's a session on Sketchflow later today. You can even look at Photoshop, Silverlight 4. I mean, the Visual Studio. There's a broad range of tools that you can do to start building and creating that product. But I thought I'd focus on a somewhat different question, which is, well, how can you actually make a product that's simple and beautiful? Right? That's kind of the next step. Not just build something, but build it in a simple and a beautiful way. And I've learned something here from some of... I've had the good fortune of working with some really, really talented industrial designers, and there's this idea that industrial designers have. So these are the people that build chairs and forms and objects. And when they look at a design, they'll speak about the three reads, the three ways of assessing a design. The first read is what the eye sees. It discovers the overall form. Then comes the touch. When you hold an object, is it cold? Is it warm? Is it rough? What's the material like? And lastly, it's the use, right? It's what's the relationship that develops. Like, is the knife sharp? Does it work for you? And so these are the three reads in which an industrial designer approaches a problem. And notice that it goes from the large all the way in. So let's make this concrete. So, the first read is form. I hope everyone had coffee, but if not, you'll be wanting coffee by the end of this. But you can look at the moment you see the shape of a cup and the ingredients in it, you know that this is something you can drink. As you come closer, you touch it. There's the warmth of the experience that is there. That the handle lures you in and says like, lift up this cup, lift up this cup, and finally you can drink it. Right? And now, you're experiencing the coffee and you're forming the bond with the coffee and that experience over time. And so industrial design usually has that flow. And, if you translate this more into interaction design or software design principles, it's a little bit different. Use will equate to features, a lot of the capabilities your clients request you to put into a product. The touch, the surfacing corresponds to controls, list controls, view controls, buttons, whatever you have it. And, the form ends up being then the look and feel of the application. And it's interesting because interaction design or software design seems to flow the other direction. And many times, to describe features and controls, I mean, people spend a lot of time on wireframes, just basic wireframes, and that is useful to a certain degree. But it is actually important to consider the whole. Look and feel and form, when you think about that, is actually how people distinguish a new product and a new experience. Right? So waiting and holding off to work on look and feel and form until the end, right? Whereas an industrial designer would never do that. I think, I have to say, like, I've seen that in many schools and different places where on the interaction design side, it just happens way too late to start considering look and feel, because this is the first read. This is the first time a person will see a user interface. It is actually the look and feel before they even touch a button or do something. So if that comes too late in the process, you're missing out. I mean, you can use look and feel to really bring in the simplicity and the beauty in a product. So in practice, how do we do this? So there's another design that I was working on, another concept, was based on the observation that more and more the nature of work is changing. right? Many years ago, or even 50 years ago, the majority of work was more manual or services-oriented, but now a good one-third of the working population fits into what's called the creative class. We're all part of the creative class because for a living, we're asked to create new things, software, tell stories, create user interface. It's always creating something new. And it's now a third of the population. It will probably grow as well. So, and a question that arises from that is how can we better support creation? When you start looking at how people's desks are organized, you realize that despite all of our technical advantages, there's something in the familiarity of paper and the tactility and the versatility of paper that is still there. And when you think about your own creative process, you might have whiteboards at home or sticky notes, that your ideas oftentimes originate in paper and somehow end up in digital form. So we live in this world that's stuck between paper and pixel right now, and we haven't really necessarily cracked the code on that. So one of our design concepts in this space, this was just a general concept, more of a concept car to look at this, is it was a two-screen device with pen and touch that you could interact with. And the main way of working with this, I mean, it's you could use it like a digital journal, but the main way of inputting information is through a pen. So the pen in this case is the main control. And pen and marksmanship have some really fantastic qualities. They can be expressive, they can be emotional, they can be precise. You can sign something into law, you can just construct a formula. People have a very personal connection to their pen and the look of a pen stroke. So, let's think a little bit about, well, what are some of the attributes of a pen stroke that matter? Like, what are some of the qualities of pen color, pen stroke that matter? Just throw shout some out. Pen would have to... Pen stroke. Well, it would need like colors. It would need you'd want to change maybe the nib style. Maybe you want a ballpoint pen. Maybe you want more a pencil. Here's the width of that, right? And in your mind's eye, now start designing a user interface, right? Think about an interface. You need to change a color somewhere, right? Change the line you maybe want to switch out the type of drawing style that you're using. I mean, just go through the exercise and in your mind's eye, develop what that user interface would look like. So does everyone have one in mind? This won't work. If you need to create a picture. Think about how you'd do that. Right. Okay, so, well, here are two solutions we came up with. And this might be very different from what you have in mind. Maybe you were envisioning your favorite Mont Blanc pen or your rotary pen or a pencil, right? But here are actually two visual designs that are pretty much doing the same thing. You can change different pen types and you can change different colors. But the one on the right, is very candy-like, has poppy bold colors. It's more playful. It's younger and fresher. The one on the left is more retro. It caters more to an artisanal side of yourself. And when you think about the broad range of writing styles and writing that people do, you need to actually start weaving down your space. You can't do writing for everyone out of the gate. You need to feel out your market, and look and feel is a tremendously great way of doing that. So... On the topic of the three reads, right? Keep in mind that when people look at a new interface, they will approach it like an object. So the first read is going to occur through the form or the look and feel. The second one is going to be how well do the controls work. And the last one is actually then the use case. So that's the flow you need to consider. And the best way to do this is to hire, to contract, to befriend an artist or a visual designer, someone who's just really good with visuals. It'll complement your team. If you already have a visual designer, that's great. But for those who don't have a visual designer, hire that person or contract them, bring them on. It'll make your work more interesting. It will make you like life more. Things will be more beautiful. And it also will save you money in the long run because you can quickly vet out opportunities, can use look and feel to see, well, I have this interface. Could it apply to this market? And you can very quickly start exploring those opportunities. And this is something like, you know, just not to, I'm going to belabor this point, with HTML5, Silverlight 4, a lot of new rich web technologies, this is going to become more important, not less. So, you know, get on with this now, bring that competency into your team, and your products are going to be simpler, they're going to be more beautiful, and that's something that can start right away. So now that we have a product, you have the right look and feel, you have a better sense of your market, the right use case, how do you really then grow the opportunity? How do you scale it? And the way of doing this is as follows. So, you know, the tricky part is anytime you're building something new, you usually just have one or two people or maybe 10 people, or maybe you've done research with 20. So you actually only validated your idea in a fairly small space. And then there's the larger market, the larger space you're going into. This could be publishing, automotive, a larger sector. And the information that you have available through industry reports is usually on the macroeconomic level. It's very, very broad. It's very generic. And the other thing about it, it's available to everyone. So you might have something very unique on the user research on your insight level, but you haven't necessarily mapped it into the larger trends, the larger opportunities. And how do you bring those two things together? And that's actually I think this is actually one of the most exciting parts of a process to start thinking about. So let's look at a specific question. So, magazines haven't really made the transition to online. People love magazines, and they're just beautiful visual experiences. So, but really looking at, just asking yourself the question, well, where is the next frontier for magazines? Where is magazine content going? And to understand that, you can start looking at market research data. So, this is somewhat of an intimidating graphic. So let's just break it down, right? So the entirety here, sort of the entire box here represents the publishing industry. So that's the market we're going into. So we're looking at. So that's a $500 billion market. So it's very, very, very large. Each slice corresponds then to the different subsectors in the publishing industry. So there's consumer books, there's magazines, there's newspapers, trade publications, all the way to educational titles. And the horizontal split here is then the split between the percentage of revenue that comes from advertising sales versus straight-up content sales. So as you expect, like an educational book, there is no advertising. And newspapers and magazines, however, are driven by a fairly large share of their revenues come from advertising. The level of redness in this graphic shows the decrease and the decline. So so newspaper advertising has actually been going down over 40% year over year. And the same with magazines as well. However, those areas where the revenue has been fairly stable, I mean, adjusted for the recent economic troubles, were businesses that relied on straight content sales. So oftentimes when you hear the death of publishing and the death of newspapers and magazines and all of this, well, what people should be saying is that, well, their advertising revenue is going down dramatically, and there are many reasons for that. There is an overabundance of inventory right now online. There are many more effective ways of tracking, or let's put it this way, there's more analytics available online for tracking, and online advertising has just been actually 100 times cheaper than print advertising. So that has been like one of the big drivers there. But it's not true that people aren't buying magazines anymore. They are, especially if they're if the content is at a level that people want to buy. So what that makes you realize is that, you know, there is actually an opportunity here to start developing very unique and differentiated content experiences and driving the content innovation forward. And we're moving into a time right now where we can do that. Like, the web is getting more powerful and more beautiful. Interactive television is coming back with Xbox 3, is going mainstream with things like Xbox 360, you could even say Google TV and Apple TV. But, you know, interactive television is really going to be coming, is coming. So there are many new opportunities to tell stories in new and more beautiful ways. So, the question is how to tell then those stories and what would be the stories. And one thing you can do now, again, is look and go for insights. Study what do people really like about their magazines today and start to project into the future. Well, what are some of the shortcomings that they see in their experience and start designing for an entire a whole content experience. What we chose to do is actually look at an HTML5 content pilot. So we started looking at a specific space and just designed for that and started envisioning a new content experience. I'm not able to play the full video here, but just to give you just to give you an idea, I mean, this is really looking at some of the new capabilities that are coming and thinking through how this will affect storytelling. So, you know, putting these things all together is that you're looking at the larger market opportunity and seeing that one, you know, even the $500 billion publishing industry, that's kind of the market opportunity that is there. It is shifting, it is changing. The area where the change is where the decrease is in creating is the largest is in the advertising area. But the straight up content space is doing relatively fine. So looking for opportunities to innovate in the content space made sense. Now, all the way down at the user level, you know, you're able to start hearing, well, what is it? What is it about where people have still open needs around their media consumption, their media habits? And then putting those two together is then through, in this case, like the way how you can build then the correlation between the market and the user opportunity is through a specific content pilot. So here we used a prototype just to vet out that link that there are people in the larger marketplace and that there are individual users that we can then show that there's this link between those two by creating a content pilot. There are other approaches how you can do this. There is doing a cross-segment analysis. So this is where you look at particular attributes in the user population that you've been studying and maybe mapping this into a segmentation that your client, or in this case Microsoft, uses. For us, like, you know, we have standard taxonomies of existing segments and then building then that cross-correlation between them. And this is literally a correlation function that you'll see from statistics. Right, it's something, well, you've studied this population, it has these attributes, here's this larger population, and the correlation is 50% or 60% or certain percentage. And that's very useful because now you can start inferring, saying it's like, well, look, you know, we're able to translate those needs we had from the specific market into a larger one. Another way which the web has now enabled is that you can continuously, as you build your product, bring in communities. And a great example for this is when you look at what Nike is doing with the development of their sports shoes. They've created specific social media websites for runners and running clubs where they give them running shoes or prototypes of running shoes and collect feedback. And this does two things. One is it allows you to make a better product, but also, and this is more importantly, it allows you to build the right product and for a set of people who will be loyalists and will speak for you. And it's one of those things that through the web we're finally able to do this, that you can, you know, that you can build a product, test the product, and build your audience along with it. So rather than having to go out and then build by advertising, you're able to even like just earn your audience as you build your product. And it's a fantastic opportunity and fantastic time to do that. Let's see. So and then going back to the innovation process. There is, you know, we've looked at, you know, how do you take insights, translate them into core ideas, how do you take a product, build that out of the core idea, and how do you go from a market, and how you then go all the way to market. Now, it's that cycle, you know, it's that cycle that we're all on, creating more and better things. And it's, you know, at some point, you know, you have to ask yourself this philosophical question of why do this at all? Why keep creating products? And for this, And especially, like, you know, you really want to create great things, right? I mean, how do you strive for greatness through all of this? And to answer that question, I think we need to ask someone who is even older than Peter Drucker and even wiser. And this is one of my favorite philosophers, Georg Friedrich Hegel. And one of his saying in his studies of history is that nothing great in the world has ever been accomplished without passion. And it's true. Right, it's really true. If you work with designers and engineers, like, the work is just better. It has a certain quality if you're deeply passionate about that. So, in one of the things, in a more modern way of saying this, and this is a term we use in our studio, it's like, you know, that your work needs to have soul. You need to be able to enjoy the people you're with. You need to be fueled by you know, your family and your friends. Take the insights from people you deeply care about, and you should be working on things you deeply care about and are passionate about. It's like there's so much stuff we can create in any given time, but why not start with the things that you personally care about and are passionate about? And it's one of those things that is underestimated oftentimes. But it's you know, if your work doesn't have soul, find it. You know, find the soul in your work. All right. So to summarize this talk, I spoke about that design is more and more affecting businesses. I'm calling this process design venturing. We shared a couple techniques from how to take an insight and move it into a core idea by asking two questions: what's unique about you and what does the world need? Discussed several techniques around creating the product, in particular the three reads: what the eye sees, the look and feel, the first way of how a person sees a product, touch or the controls, someone interacts, and then the use. And then lastly, some techniques for mapping from user insight to a broader market. And throughout all of this, you know, never forget, just only do it if there's soul in it. So with that, thank you, and we'll do some Q&A.